The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time is dated July 5/July 12, 2021. As usual, it features the red border on the front cover. Time, the large block letters spelling Time, are in gray superimposed upon a white background, upon which it looks like a page from a worn-out textbook. The pages are dog-eared. This is a photograph by Time. And it doesn't really have lines of text, but it has a lot of blacked out lines, some of which contain words or numbers. And I'll read to you from top to bottom what they say. Critical Race Theory, 1619, Board of Education, 1776. Patriots, Controversial Issues of Public Policy and Social Affairs. Concerned Parents, America. Patriotism, Advocacy Groups, Curriculum. Historical Facts, Slavery, Patriotic Education. Declaration of Independence, Inclusion, Civil Rights. Endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Headline atop the former print, the print that I just read, in bold black, highlighted in yellow, The History Wars. And there are a few notes in the margin. This will be on the test with an asterisk. What does this say about America? Is this really true? The page number 114 is circled. And there's some doodling going on in the margins, an American flag, a Statue of Liberty, the eagle with the shield of the USA atop it, and just some scribbles like one would do to make sure one's ink pen was working properly. Proceeding with the text now, the first page for the record. Missiles are not negotiable. Stated by Ebrahim Raisi, Iran's president-elect, in a June 21 press conference discussing negotiations with the U.S. over its nuclear capabilities. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. Carl Nassib, N-A-S-S-I-B, Las Vegas Raiders defensive lineman, coming out in a June 21 video message and becoming the first openly gay, active NFL player. 10,000, maximum number of fans allowed to watch Olympic events in person in Japan this summer, per organizers, June 21. Good news of the week. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs announced June 20 gender confirmation surgery for transgender veterans will be covered by VA health insurance for the first time. There is no happiness in life. There's only a mirage on the horizon. Vladimir Putin, President of Russia, quoting Leo Tolstoy, June 16, after being asked if his summit with U.S. President Joe Biden had built trust between their two nations. A herring for a jab. Who could possibly resist? And herring is H-E-R-R-I-N-G. Said by Agnes Leavis, Director of the Netherlands Fish Marketing Board, In a June 16 interview announcing that all Dutch residents receiving COVID-19 vaccines will receive a gift of Hollandse Nieuwe soused herring. 15 million number of boxes of Girl Scout cookies that went unsold in 2021. As the pandemic put constraints on in-person sales, the organization told the Associated Press June 14. Can you please repeat that? Cindy Greenberg, president and CEO of youth community service organization Repair the World, recalling her initial response to a $7 million donation from billionaire Mackenzie Scott in an interview with Time published June 17. The View, this is Sports Today, Justice for NCAA Athletes by Sean Gregory. For years, critics of the college sports business model, which tends to enrich schools and administrators, but not the actual players, have relished the potential of a Supreme Court ruling against the NCAA. The June 21 unanimous court opinion, which allows schools to provide uncapped education benefits to college athletes, offers real change in college sports. But for the good stuff, go to Kavanaugh. As in the concurring opinion of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh took a sharp turn from the measured approach in criticizing NCAA arguments offered by Justice Neil Gorsuch, who authored the principal opinion of the case, National Collegiate Athletic Association v. Alston. It should not be entirely surprising during oral arguments in NCAA v. Alston, which questioned whether the NCAA was permitted to cap education-related benefits to college athletes, a district court ruled that it could not, and the Supreme Court upheld the decision June 21. Kavanaugh was particularly aggressive in his questioning of NCAA lawyers. It does seem schools are conspiring with competitors, agreeing with competitors, let's say that, to pay no salaries for the workers who are making the schools billions of dollars on the theory that consumers want the schools to pay their workers nothing, Kavanaugh said during the March 31 proceedings. And that just seems entirely circular and even somewhat disturbing. In his opinion, Kavanaugh seemed to invite more legal challenges to the NCAA's caps on all forms of compensation for athletes, not just those tethered to education, which was the narrower focus of this particular Supreme Court case. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate, Kavanaugh wrote. And under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be any different. The NCAA is not above the law. Those words from a Supreme Court justice, no less, serve as a useful rallying cry, sure to be quoted by lawyers representing college athletes and college athletes themselves for years to come. Not that a ruling that allows schools to offer athletes additional education-related benefits like scholarships for graduate school, internships, and computer equipment is not of great importance on its own. These items are intrinsically valuable to college athletes. Second, the timing of a Supreme Court victory for college athletes could not be better as they fight for additional economic rights. July 1, state laws allowing athletes to profit from their own name, image, and likeness, NIL, are set to go into effect in Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, New Mexico, and Texas. The NCAA has pushed for Congress to pass a national NIL law by July 1, but that's been unlikely. Although the court did not rule on the rights of athletes to secure third-party sponsorships in NCAA v. Alston, it did strike down the NCAA's continued reliance on language from a 1984 Supreme Court case to justify its commitment to curtailing compensation. The court, wrote Gorsuch, could not agree with the NCAA's long-standing argument that, essentially, amateurism must be maintained because it says so, and that a 37-year-old Supreme Court opinion justifies this stance. The court also noted the massive size of the NCAA's business, pointing out that those who run this enterprise profit in a different way than the student-athletes whose activities they oversee. So while the court was careful not to officially settle the debate about whether athletes have rights to all forms of compensation, agreeing with an appeals court that the national debate about amateurism in college sports is important, but our task as appellate judges is not to resolve it, nor could we. A reasonable takeaway from the court seems clear. The current model is broken. Kavanaugh makes things even clearer. The NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America, he wrote. He also cites a brief filed by a group of African-American antitrust lawyers that squarely frames the issue as a civil rights one. College presidents, athletic directors, coaches, conference commissioners, and NCAA executives take in 6- and 7-figure salaries, Kavanaugh wrote. Colleges build lavish new facilities, but the student athletes who generate the revenues, many of whom are African American and from lower income backgrounds, end up with little or nothing. The Supreme Court may not have blown up college sports with one swipe of the pen, but college athletes will soon get their fairer share, thanks to the court. There's a photo that accompanies this article. It's a football field. There are fans filling the stands. I see lots of gold color, or maybe it's orange. It's a dull orange, if that's the case. There are two referees on the field, and two very large young men are jumping high into the air. The back of the shirt of one reads Alston, A-L-S-T-O-N. His number is 20. The other guy's number is 3. But looking at number 20, who is jumping, I'm sure, at least 3 feet into the air, West Virginia running back Sean Alston, who in 2014 filed an antitrust suit against the NCAA, just ruled on by the Supreme Court, celebrates a score. Under the heading Business Ready to Sail, this is written by Eben Shapiro. With Celebrity Cruises preparing for its first departure from a U.S. port in 15 months, June 26, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which it did, CEO Lisa Lutoff-Perlo acknowledges cruising is not first on everybody's list of reopening activities. She tells Time, I've been in this business 36 years, and long before COVID, people said, oh, I don't think cruising is for me. So I am not surprised when people say cruising might not be at the top of their list of vacation choices. Still, she claims her company's ships are probably the safest place you can be on the planet right now. If I'm traveling or if I'm going out to dinner and I'm sitting in a crowded restaurant with no social distancing and no requirements for vaccinations and I do not know who I'm sitting next to, I would feel much safer on a cruise ship right now than I would just about anywhere else, including traveling on an airplane. Still, she adds, there have been cruise rejectors since the beginning of time. There will be cruise rejectors long after I retire from this business. Here's a small photo of Lisa Lutoff-Perlo, CEO of Celebrity Cruises. She's smiling. She has long blonde hair. She's wearing a black outfit with two strands of beads, maybe pearls, maybe not, and pearl-like earrings. The risk report, France faces an uncertain future as the Macron dream falters, by Ian Bremmer. following a three-month pandemic delay. French voters went to the polls June 20 for the first round of local elections, which will fill the seats of assemblies in France's 13 regions and 96 departments. There will be a second round of voting, June 27, but the electorate's already sent some clear messages. President Emmanuel Macron's party, La République En Marche, LREM, has little support. Main opposition leader Marine Le Pen and her right-wing National Rally Party are not expanding their base, and a record number of eligible French voters cannot be bothered to vote. 4 years ago, the French electorate cast a ballot for change. In presidential voting, the traditional center-right finished in third place behind Le Pen and her far-right party. The traditional center-left socialists finished in fifth place behind the Communist Party. The winner was Macron, a man who had never before run for office at the head of a party he created from scratch little more than a year earlier. Macron's party won an astounding 308 of 577 seats in the Assemblée Nationale, France's powerful lower house of parliament. Once in office, the goal of any change candidate is to convince voters he or she has made life better and the country stronger, so that future elections will reject more change in favor of a new status quo. But June 20, Macron's LREM won just 11% of the vote, on par with the Green Party and the Socialists. That is less of a shock than you might think. Incumbent parties rarely fare well in France's local elections, and LREM did not exist in 2015, the last time they were held. But there's nothing in these numbers to boost Macron's confidence as he heads into a bitter re-election fight next year. His best hope for now is that a swooning economy, pandemic lockdown fatigue, and an initially slow vaccine rollout will give way to renewal by year's end. His other hope is that the opposition will not get its act together, and here's a rare bit of positive news for Macron. Le Pen's national rally, which was expected to finish first in local elections, scored just 19% after taking more than 28% in 2015. The center-right Les Républicains, the political heirs to Charles de Gaulle, Jacques Chirac, and Nicolas Sarkozy, won about 29%. Many experts and voters had predicted a Macron-Le Pen matchup in next year's presidential second-round runoff. Opinion polls had suggested Le Pen has expanded the National Rally support base beyond voters who like the anti-immigrant, anti-EU, Islamophobic, and sometimes anti-Semitic image of the National Front, the party's predecessor. Created nearly 50 years ago by Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie. But these numbers tell a different story, feeding persistent doubts that she can ever win a majority of voters. Le Pen has name recognition, that's L-E space P-E-N, and an ability to attract media coverage, but we should not mistake those advantages for national electability. Yet there's also evidence that voters have their doubts. Any party can bring real change to France. Only about one-third of eligible voters bothered to show up, a 17-point drop from 2015, and an all-time low for the Republic. There was one winner from this muddle, Xavier Bertrand of the center-right Les Républicains, has emerged as a serious challenger for president next year. It is too early to know whether remarkably low turnout in regional elections has provided an accurate picture of the national mood in 2021. But maybe Bertrand is the fresh face who can sweep past an opposition figure, Le Pen, who has spent most of her political career trying to reinvent her party and then oust Macron. The View essay. Grateful for the hugs I can share, haunted by the ones I can't. by Nicole Chung, who's author of All You Can Ever Know, K-N-O-W. I am at the stage of pandemic life when I'm still counting hugs. The first time I invited a good friend, not just over to, but into my house, post-vaccination, saw masks. I could not even wait till she walked up to my door. I ran outside to greet her, and we tackle-hugged each other in the driveway. We both held on tight the otherworldly buzz of 1,000 cicadas in our ears as we took turns exclaiming how good it was to see each other. We had not hung out in person since January 2020. And, of course, I was looking forward to talking, sharing a meal, catching up on all her news. But somehow I'd forgotten that before any of that happened, I would also get to hug her. It was my first hug from a friend in more than a year, and a reminder of just how comforting a good hug can be. I have been a hugger since middle school, when my friends and I would run up to one another in the halls between classes and embrace as though we had not just seen one another the day before and would not see one another again at lunch. In high school, I volunteered at a Girl Scouts camp every summer, and at the end of each session, many of our campers would seek us out to say goodbye. My fellow counselors and I would typically offer them a choice: hug, handshake, or high five. Most of the kids would choose a hug, but there were always at least a few who would opt for a high five, some slapping hard enough to make my hand sting a little, or a handshake, at times delivered so solemnly I felt like we were going into business together. I always appreciated this ritual, especially the individual ask, because it allowed me to think about and honor each camper's wishes. As I venture out from my pandemic bubble, I hope to bring the same kind of intentionality to every much-anticipated reunion. In March 2020, when our once far-ranging lives shrank to texts, phone calls, and faces on screens, I knew my family and I were going to miss seeing close friends and relatives in person. But over the past year, I've also caught myself feeling bereft over the absence of briefer interactions, even those impromptu two-ships-passing moments with more casual friends. I've missed the experience of meeting someone new, striking up a conversation, realizing you might be friends in the making. I've missed running into old friends on my travels or going to a reading or event alone and reconnecting with someone I had not expected to see. I know I'm very lucky not to have gone without human contact in the last year of relative social isolation. With my spouse and I working from home, our kids attending virtual school, and now a 54-pound puppy zooming from room to room, the house has felt far from empty. Thanks to my family, as well as the dog, who can really hold her ground when tackle-hugged, as she frequently is, I've also not had to go without hugs. But just as there are many different kinds of relationships and friendships, there are also many different kinds of hugs. And I've missed the satisfying hugs you share with friends you have not seen in a while, quick hugs you exchange with frequent companions when you sit down for coffee, the long hug you might give a favorite relative before you part ways. Most of all, I am haunted by the hugs I will never get to give my mother, who died of cancer early in the pandemic. I have a lifetime of her love and affection to remember. I know the exact day we must have hugged for the last time, weeks before COVID-19 forced shutdowns and stay-at-home orders throughout the country. But I do not remember our final hug itself, how long we held on, or how tight, or her exact words before I left for the airport, because I thought I'd be back soon. I did not know it was the last time I would ever see her. I have spent my entire adult life far from my family and many of the people I'm closest to, so I've often had to rely on letters and texts and calls to maintain these important connections, let the people I love know what I'm feeling. I have long been confident in my ability to express myself in words, written or spoken, but when my mother was dying and the pandemic kept me from her, I was constantly aware of just how much could not be expressed in words, especially once she had a harder time speaking or following the conversation. Although I called nearly every day, it never seemed like enough. By the end, she was mostly listening while I told her I loved her. How much more, I thought, would it mean to both of us if I could simply sit next to her and hold her hand in silence? How much more might she feel my love if she could feel my arms around her? After she died, I was incredibly fortunate in the support I had from loved ones near and far. Friends sent food and flowers, cards and video messages. Neighbors wearing masks waved at me through my kitchen window, left bouquets on the front step. But none of them could come into the house, sit beside me, and listen to a story or give me a hug, and this felt like its own kind of loss. Watching my mother's live-streamed funeral from across the country, I realized that even an on-site gathering could feel lonely, absent the embraces and comforting touches we often look for and expect when we mourn. Very few people could attend because of COVID-19 restrictions, and no one hugged anyone else. They all stayed a responsible 6 feet apart, masks on, their faces and emotions more than half hidden from one another. Once or twice I saw friends reaching out to one another across from a distance, but they knew they could not come close enough for a real hug. Lower infection rates and vaccinations came too late for my mom and me, and so many others, to have the last visits, the last hugs we wanted. Still, I am grateful to be vaccinated now, to find myself looking forward to life in the hopefully not too distant future when my entire family is protected. Slowly, unbelievably, it is becoming more commonplace to socialize with people outside our household, to meet a friend for dinner or drinks or have people over to our house. We invited some friends and their dog to a cookout Memorial Day, greeting them with unmasked grins and open arms. And when the following weekend brought not one but two small get-togethers, one of my kids joked, "It's just like the old days." Next month, I will finally get to see my sister for the first time since Christmas 2019. It feels so good to share space with our loved ones, even though I will never stop wishing I could see and hug my mom again. And I know it will be some time before I'm able to travel to see all of my nearest and dearest, who are scattered throughout the country. When I do see them, though, they've been warned I have a lot of hugging to make up for. I expect I will never take it for granted again. The View, Q&A, Frontiers of Medicine, A New Way to Fight Racial Disparities in Health Care, by Angelina Jolie. When Malone Mukwende, that's Mukwende, 21, started medical school in London, he identified a fundamental problem. Almost all the images and data used in its teaching were based on studies of white patients. But medical symptoms can present very differently on black and brown skin, leading to misdiagnosis, suffering, and even death. Still a student, he's launched both a handbook, Mind the Gap, and Hutano, a new online platform intended to empower people with knowledge about their health. How would you explain Mind the Gap, is the question asked. Answer, I got to medical school and noticed there was a gap in our teaching. If we learned about a particular type of rash or disease that manifests on skin, it would always have white skin as the reference. I would ask, what does this look like on other skin tones, just from my own learning? Often people told me they did not know. I decided something needed to be done. Some members of staff at the university and I started collating pictures and descriptions of different conditions on darker skin, and we compiled them all into a handbook we called Mind the Gap. Question, the gap isn't there just because there haven't been studies on black and brown skin. It is because it was not considered important, right? Answer, After the publication of Mind the Gap, someone reached out to me who is a student in Zimbabwe. They said all the books and reference images they use are also from white skin, even though the population is predominantly of darker skin. It really shows you that the legacies of colonialism are still living in 2021. Question. I have children from different backgrounds, and I know when there was a rash that everybody got, it looked drastically different depending on their skin color. But whenever I looked at medical charts, the reference point was always white skin. Recently, my daughter Zahara, whom I adopted from Ethiopia, had surgery, and afterward, a nurse told me to call them if her skin turned pink. Answer. Almost the entirety of medicine is taught in that way. There is a language and culture that exists in the medical profession because it's been done for so many years that because we're still doing it so many years later, it does not seem like a problem. Question. Now that there is so much online, it should be so much easier. So what is your new digital platform? And why are you calling it Hutano? Now that is spelled H-U-T-A-N-O. Answer. Hutano in my native language, Shona, translates directly to health. It's a health social platform where people from all over the world can connect and really discuss these different conditions. Question. What do you hope it will achieve? Answer. We want people who are living with these conditions to have a platform to be seen and empower their health care literacy. We need to start empowering the individual, and that, I hope, will start to reduce some of the health care disparities that exist. Question. And this goes beyond just looking at skin, doesn't it? There are wider problems with our medical knowledge and our evidence and our measurements. Answer. It is the politics of medicine. For instance, if you read an old medical textbook, it will tell you from a European perspective that a 70-kilogram, 154-pound, 25-year-old male is the reference point. And if you're above that, you are obese. And if you're below that, you are malnourished. And who came up with this scale? We like to say medicine is evidence-based, but we need to question where our evidence is coming from. A lot of the studies only included people from Europe and America. And finally, question, how do we recalculate? Answer, I cannot say I have a solution, because if we decide to group by age, that will also open a can of worms. The same is true if we group by race, if we group by income. It just depends on individual circumstances a lot of the time. If individual people are empowered, they will have an adequate amount of information or an adequate ability to ask the right questions about their health care. Beneath the heading, The View, Politics. It's the queerest Congress ever. It Doesn't Feel Like It by Philip Elliott. For many Americans, it is all too easy to assume that the fight for LGBTQ rights has been won. After all, same-sex couples have enjoyed the same right to marriage as their straight neighbors since 2015. The Supreme Court ruled last year a person's sexuality alone is not a justifiable reason for them to lose their job. Support for same-sex relationships is at a record high, while major corporations for the past month have been bathing consumers in rainbow-hued marketing and affirmations amid pride celebrations. In Washington, D.C., more LGBTQ lawmakers than ever before are in power at the Capitol. And Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is the first openly gay member of a presidential cabinet. But Americans would be better served by benching gestures of performative allyship and recognizing just how many ways this country still discriminates in perfectly legal ways against the LGBTQ community. From financial contracts to mental health services, housing to parenthood, Institutions find ways, large and small, to stack the deck against LGBTQ people. In just one example, a 2018 study found LGBTQ students left college with about $16,000 more student debt than their straight classmates, owing to factors like decreased family support. They're requiring more time to finish a degree, and external costs like counseling. At the federal level, some steps are being considered to provide LGBTQ people with more support. The Equality Act, the most sweeping rewrite of civil rights laws since the 1960s, would offer protections for fair access to housing, education, and even jury service without regard to sexuality or gender. But the legislation is stuck in the Senate. Meanwhile, a bevy of efforts are underway to roll back existing protections. Dozens of bills are winding their way through state capitals to make it more difficult, if not impossible, for transgender students to play school sports or use restrooms corresponding to their gender identity. Self-styled religious liberty laws that permit discrimination in the name of faith are chugging along with few checks in state legislators that are dominated by Republicans. And in June, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously Philadelphia was on the wrong side of the law when it said that to receive city funding, a Catholic social service agency had to provide services to same-sex couples looking to adopt. Against this backdrop, Time spoke with two co-chairs of the Congressional LGBTQ Plus Equality Caucus. Representatives Charisse Davids of Kansas and Mondaer Jones of New York. As part of its 2021 virtual Pride Summit highlighting perspectives on identity, creativity, and equality. Both Democrats, they've made history. Davids in 2018 as the first openly LGBTQ Native American elected to Congress, and Jones as one of two gay black men elected to Congress in 2020 elections. It is important that we're living authentically and visibly, giving inspirations to kids like I was when I was growing up, wondering if there was a place for me in a world filled with so much injustice, Jones tells Time. And of course, you have to shoulder some of the important work that the LGBTQ movement has still yet to accomplish. They may be firsts, but they're not ones to puff up their chests just because they will have places in future history books. A lot of people know what it's like to be the only person like them in the room, Davids says. And even with the strides being made to ensure Congress is more representative of America's changing demographics, there is still plenty more work to do. Of the 535 voting members of Congress, just 11 identify publicly as LGBTQ. Under the heading Health, Cody Howard standing at a makeshift pulpit under an overpass preaching about the COVID-19 vaccine. The pastor of a congregation which he calls Church Under the Bridge serves the homeless of Texarkana, Texas. And Howard delivers a crucial message. He got the shot. He admits science and the authorities are not yet 100% sure about the long-term effects of this thing and emphasizes that every person can make up their own mind, but he says his own decision is to get vaccinated. And it was a response to a question posed by a core tenet of Christianity. Will it help my neighbor? Plenty of the three dozen or so attendees on this rainy June morning are skeptical. When COVID-19 first started spreading, they said it's like a high-powered flu or pneumonia, says Tony Wood, referring to comments like those made by former President Donald Trump. And I've had pneumonia. Others appear supportive, but none act on the pastor's sermon. Howard, undeterred, gestures to a mobile vaccine bus parked nearby from the Christus St. Michael Health System, a local hospital group. His long hair, lanky build, and red T-shirt evoking a casual, Christ-like figure leading his flock. What Howard's listeners do not know is that he's carrying a message from a less divine source, the federal government, or more specifically, the White House. The Christus Health System is a member of the Catholic Health Association of the U.S., CHA, which is part of the COVID-19 Community Core, a Biden administration effort to persuade hesitant Americans like Wood to get vaccinated. The Corps is a loose network of more than 4,000 organizations meeting regularly with the White House to share information on vaccines. The faith leaders, community groups, and physicians who make up the Corps receive data, tool kits, and talking points from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and tailor them to specific communities across the country. The experiment may be the Biden administration's best hope to beat COVID-19. The U.S. must fully vaccinate at least 70% of its population to contain the virus, public health experts say. As of June 21, CDC data show even among those eligible for a vaccine, the country remains 17 percentage points short of that goal, which experts believe will bring what is known as herd immunity. As some Americans resist getting the shot, average daily vaccinations have slowed from a high of 3.4 million in early April to slightly over 850,000 in mid-June. With new strains emerging around the world, including the faster-spreading Delta variant, millions of American lives are potentially at risk, says Dr. Krishna Udayakumar, director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. We're going to have to increase the rate of vaccinations in the U.S. in order to avoid another surge, he says. Biden has staked the success of his first year on getting enough people vaccinated to reopen society, saying this spring he wanted 70% of the adult population to have at least one shot by July 4. He's also declared the larger goal of showing Americans the federal government can be a powerful force for good. The COVID-19 Community Core sits at the uneasy crux of those two objectives. How can the federal government persuade people who do not trust the federal government to get vaccinated? Through the Core, the administration thinks it's found a way by filtering a federal message through trusted local sources. But building trust is hard. Howard, for instance, says he has to avoid emphasizing any ties to Washington. The more that we put that out there, he says, the more distrustful they are. Person by person, the Corps is trying to chip away at bitter politics and entrenched resistance to federal intervention. While polling shows vaccine hesitancy has declined since Biden took office, it is difficult to quantify how much can be attributed to the Corps. But if the program works, it could save lives and usher in a post-pandemic reality where Americans have a rebuilt faith in federal leadership. You can lead in government by being at the forefront and being the loudest voice in the room, says Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. But you can also lead by supporting leaders and communities and giving them the tools and resources and information and support they need. Less than a week before the inauguration, when vaccines were still restricted to the most vulnerable, and even they were frantically refreshing their computer browsers to find appointments, Biden's COVID-19 response team was planning for the days when there would be too many vaccines. Courtney Rowe and Ben Wakana, the officials in charge of the White House's COVID-19 communication strategy, knew that by spring, a surplus of shots would make hesitancy the biggest barrier to vaccination. Research they conducted during the presidential transition showed they needed local leaders from churches, social service agencies, and hospitals to mitigate the problem. But they also needed unified, top-down messaging to counter disinformation about the vaccines. They decided these two strategies could work in tandem. The White House could recruit grassroots organizations to persuade hesitant Americans and arm them with information from the federal government. It was a risk, says Wakana. The government has not really played this role before. Wakana and Roe spent the winter monitoring polls about hesitancy. They found minority, rural, and evangelical communities were the most skeptical, and they began drawing up lists of recruits from the NAACP, NASCAR, and the American Red Cross, to the National Association of Evangelicals, the American Farm Bureau Federation, and the Black Women's Round Table. By March 27, they had more than 200 names. Administration officials designed invitations on White House letterhead, asking them to be founding members of a core that would share science-based information directly with community leaders and organizations around the country, according to a copy reviewed by Time. Wakana thought they would receive 50 positive responses. They ended up with over 275 founding members. Walter Kim, K-I-M, head of the National Association of Evangelicals, was among those who immediately signed on. He was impressed by the administration's desire to engage evangelical Christians, even though three-quarters of them had voted for Trump in the 2020 election, according to exit polls. I have appreciated in this administration the recognition that we're going to have to partner with a lot of different types of people, regardless of their political affiliations, he says. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation's latest tracking poll, 27% of Republicans say they will definitely not get vaccinated, compared with 3% of Democrats. On April 13, the two-week-old core faced its first big test. As states expanded vaccine eligibility to all adults over age 16, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and CDC temporarily paused the use of the Johnson & Johnson, J&J, vaccine after six women who had taken it developed severe blood clots. Local health officials, especially those in rural areas where J&J's single dose held particular appeal, were afraid the news would stoke hesitancy. Within hours of the pause, the administration mobilized the Corps. Murthy convened more than 1,000 members for a Zoom call, led by Dr. Anthony Fauci, and circulated a letter explaining the blood clots were incredibly rare, and the pause embodied the administration's careful approach. For core members like the CHA, having quick access to answers from the CDC and the FDA was crucial. Brian Reardon, Vice President of Communications and Marketing at the CHA, had already been working with a group of about 50 other Catholic organizations to share COVID-19 vaccine talking points. And soon after the J&J pause, he sent them several links to reliable, updated information. It is a matter of organizing our communication and being consistent, he says. In late April, when core members told the White House some in their community were worried about the vaccine's quick production, Murthy organized a Zoom call with Kismekia Corbett, an immunologist at the NIH who helped develop the Moderna vaccine, to explain how the mRNA technology in the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna shots had been in the works for over two decades. When the FDA authorized the Pfizer vaccine for emergency use in adolescents, Murthy gathered hundreds of parents, youth group leaders, pediatricians, and educators on a May 19 virtual roundtable to talk about the change. When we thought about the community core, says Murthy, we always in the beginning thought of it as a bi-directional channel, a place where not only would we have information to share, but also where we would have the ability to learn from people, and they would also have the ability to teach each other. And in some places, it's worked. Renea Jones Rogers knew her livelihood depended on getting more than just herself vaccinated. This spring, the second generation co-owner of a 600-acre tomato farm in Unicoi, Tennessee, started receiving newsletters, emails, and social media updates about the COVID-19 vaccines from the American Farm Bureau, a founding Community Core member. Jones Rogers, who's her local Farm Bureau president, had already been vaccinated, but most of her employees who come from Mexico using the guest worker program each year do not speak English and are not familiar with the U.S. healthcare system. If they did not get vaccinated, that could mean close to 200 people on her farm, still vulnerable to COVID-19, potentially spreading it among themselves and in the small town nearby. In April, Jones Rogers contacted her regional health department to bring vaccines to her farm, and so far every one of this summer's roughly 80 workers has been vaccinated. Arturo Gamino was one. He does not like needles, but he had seen people die very ugly deaths from COVID-19 last year, he says through an interpreter. After he received a Spanish language printout from the CDC explaining how mRNA vaccines work, he rolled up the sleeve of his white work shirt one morning in June to get his shot. But Jones Rogers' story may be more the exception than the rule. With just 36% of its residents fully vaccinated, Tennessee's still in the bottom 10 states in the country by that metric, and other community core-aided efforts are moving much more slowly. Back in Texarkana, the Christus Health System faces its own obstacles. Just 25% of people over age 12 in Bowie County, where Texarkana is located, have been vaccinated. Christus says doctors and faith leaders adapt information from federal officials for the heavily religious community, but they had to close their mass vaccination site by the first week of May because interest was drying up. That was one reason they partnered with local leaders like Cody Howard, the street preacher, who's also the executive director of Mission Texarkana, which serves the small city's poor and homeless community. After Howard's rainy church service in June, the Christus vaccine bus heads over to a nearby homeless shelter. There, James Hunt ambles up to the bus. He says he's excited to get the vaccine so he can stop wearing a mask when he stays in the shelter. The team answers his questions, and he leaves the vaccine bus with his packet of CDC-approved information, a lollipop, and a grin, mask around his chin. But for all the preaching and educating and mobilizing, a half day of effort in Texarkana has resulted in vaccinations for just 6 people. Wood, the skeptical worshiper from the morning service, is not among them. I know just about everybody from the mission, and they're all wonderful people, Wood says. But he's still wary he could get sick from the COVID-19 shot itself, despite the day's assurances it is safe. I know some people who took it, and they had no problems with it, but, he trails off, I don't want to take the shot. This article has reporting by Alejandro de la Garza, and here are a couple of photos. Cody Howard, the preacher, is standing under an underpass. There are high pillars of cement behind him and like a ceiling of concrete and in above him, and in the background is that embankment. It's partly grassy and partly concrete filled. He is tall. He has shoulder length, at least, blondish brown hair. facial hair matching. He's wearing a dull red t-shirt over blue jeans. Howard says getting the COVID-19 shot is a Christian duty. The Christus St. Michael Mobile Health Unit gives out COVID-19 vaccines. It's like a bus. It's like a very large recreational vehicle, or it's not a mini bus, but it's not the size of a city bus either. But it's slick looking. It's white with purple trim horizontally along the side. And it says, I think it says Spirit of St. Michael on the side. All I can read is the P-I-R-I-T of St. Michael. Christus St. Michael and the logo in smaller print next to the door. And the door is open. There are two or three steps up to the interior of the bus. And it's probably a nurse or a medical technician who's holding the door open for somebody. And the individual on the inside is wearing a mask and wearing black scrubs. And the first person to enter is a man wearing very droopy-looking blue jeans or pants and a white t-shirt and a white cap and using a walker. And behind him stands what looks like a younger woman with long brown hair and plaid pants and a greenish shirt and a backpack slung over her back. So Christus St. Michael's vaccine bus has at least two customers there. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Call us here at the office and studios at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.